You're listening to Bit by Bit, July 21st, 2010.
This is Zoe Sprinkle reporting from North Station, waiting for my train again. And we are here to listen to some BLC keynote presentations. Today is, my dad will tell you,
Richard Halkett.
He is the Director of Strategy and Research Global Education, Cisco in London.
And he asked a question, I'm going to see if you remember it. This was worth a flip camera, you'll hear it in the talk. Where does the name Cisco come from? You can't remember it?
Don't.
I never knew this, but it comes from, people will hear it in the talk. We won't tell them, they'll have to listen for it. But we did not win a flip video
from
the Cisco.
Our hands.
That's right. But we did try Googling it. So great talk, very, very inspiring from a global view. I know you're going to enjoy it. Every day we'll be putting up a new keynote or workshop from the Building Learning Communities. And you know what I'm thinking is every day we keep bringing them back to North Station to this July 26th while we're sitting here because we're getting all the intros done. Must be quite confusing. You think
yes.
It is? All right. Enjoy. Richard Halkett coming from Cisco at the Building Learning Communities Conference from the Allen November Group in downtown Boston, 2010.
Fit together. In fact, I was telling Richard, I have a city planning degree, and in city planning, you're taught about every system, how everything fits together. You know, water, sewer, buildings, highway, emergency, just all the systems. You have to think about everything and how they all fit together. And I think you're going to see some systems thinking. So for those of you who really are at that level of systems thinking, I think you're really going to be quite challenged by Richard's presentation. And I also want to make a little process announcement. Richard's going to give away some prizes for the best responses to some intellectual challenges that he's going to pose to you. The first one, and I'm going to take responsibility, this is my fault, I've suggested that before he even gets started, he offer a challenge to you, and it is, may I say, two flip cams, but the deal with the two is your partner, you have to find a partner to have the conversation of coming up with the answer, your partner cannot be from your district or school. So you're just gonna find somebody nearby who you didn't come with. Fair enough? That way we're distributing things more widely. That was my suggestion, so you blame me for that one, though not blame Richard. Okay, all good. And then, just to introduce some folks, and I got a glare on my glasses here, so I can't see quite where everybody is. But there's a couple of colleagues from Cisco that came with Richard. There's Debbie Lytle, who's right here, and Gene Longo. And Debbie and Gene represent global education. Have you heard of Cisco? They made the internet work, you know. And I'm quite proud to announce that Venmo Learning has a partnership with Cisco. We're going to be doing a lot of content development, looking at leadership stuff, just a whole range of amazing things. In fact, we have a podcast series with Richard and I. One of those is out now. There's going to be a series of those coming. So I'm just quite proud to be in association with Cisco on all that. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce Richard Halkett, who's global education strategic thinker type, is what I think of Richard, one of the most amazing systems thinkers I've had a chance to talk to in my career. So with that, Richard, please come up. Welcome to BLC. And Debbie and Gene, is that what you decided? Debbie and Gene have mics, and they'll be going around and picking on some folks for the first prize.
Thank you, Al. Talk about a build-up, that's pretty hard to follow, that kind of introduction. First of all, hello, I am Richard Halkett. I'm the Director of Strategy and Research at Cisco in Global Education. I've been working in education and technology for over a decade, and this is a bit like Woodstock for me. But it does have less mud, which is great, as far as I'm concerned. So, first of all, minor technical pitch. But what we'll do is we'll sort this out while I ask that question that Alan advertised. So the question we're going to have, we're going to give you a minute to discuss with the person who's not from your district. The question is quite straightforward, really, or at least it is for me, which is, why is Cisco called Cisco? So you've got a minute, start now, and by that time we'll get this sorted out. Go. So I thought I'd go at the smart end of the spectrum rather than try to go anywhere in between. But when I arrived in the US, and I'd been working on with Cisco on education before, I was intimately familiar with the work of November Learning and the move to try to transform education around the world. And we call this building a learning society from the ground up, because this is a groundswell movement that I see here. There are other efforts that go on from the top, but this is a groundswell movement, and this, I think, is the fundamental component. So Cisco's involved in this around the world. We have involvement in the US, in Europe, in China, in Jordan, all around the world. We also have our Networking Academies program, which since its inception over a decade ago has trained 3 million students in basic networking skills. It's one of the largest programs in this country, and we draw quite a lot of our knowledge about education and 21st century skills and how it all fits together from that program. So the crucial point about this, I think, is that obviously in this room, you're not alone, but in the wider world, you're not alone in terms of campaigning for educational transformation. And sometimes it seems like quite a struggle. And I'm going to talk about the way in which you can identify real change, the way in which you can help drive it forward, and how, frankly, you can also avoid putting effort into things that aren't really worth the effort. And one thing I will say is, you know, working just this year in the Middle East, in China, in Brazil, in Mexico, and here in the US, change will come. This is going to happen. The kind of future that you're working towards for education is happening, and it's happening everywhere. But we have to be careful. In technology, the smart people say that we overestimate what will change in 2 years, but we dramatically underestimate what will happen in 20 years. And I think in education, you know, we're absolutely on the 20-year track, but we're probably at least halfway through. I'm going to talk about innovation. So innovation can be a sort of nothing word, okay? Innovation is everywhere. It can be, you know, you think of this, you think of the space shuttle, you think of iPads, you think of the iPod, you think of men in white coats doing things with bubbling test tubes. And everyone has these sort of different conceptions of innovation, but for everybody, it means change. And change can be challenging, it can be frightening, and it's certainly, by definition, disruptive. So my goal today is to talk about educational innovation and to talk about what I call responsible innovation. Because, and this might seem strange coming from someone like me who's worked on innovation and innovation policy for pretty much my entire career, all innovation is not good, and more of it is not necessarily better. And we have to understand which bits are good and which bits we should really leave behind, because every time we innovate, we cause a huge amount of disruption to existing processes that may work. So we have to be responsible innovators, and we have to understand how to make that change. And what I'd also like is I'd like you to leave today with the feeling of, you know, owning innovation, having a good relationship with innovation. So, you know, think of it, you know, it's sort of like domesticating a dog. It could be sort of vicious, but what I'm saying is I'm thinking of making it a concept that's sort of going to bring you your slippers rather than terrorize the mailman. That's the idea. So the idea is that you feel comfortable with innovation by the end of this session. So the question is, how do you get there from here? We know where we are. All schools are at a different stage in the innovation cycle. The question is we've got some sort of vision of the future. How do you get there from here? But first of all, I want to look at some perspectives on the learning society. And those of you who were here yesterday would have noticed Debbie and Russ wandering around doing video interviews with a few people. So a number of you out there are going to see yourselves up here, because what we did is we tried to get some perspectives on the learning society. And first of all, I want to say education and innovation have a tense relationship. Education is, it's different from many other industries. First of all, education is really important. This quote from H.G. Wells, I just love. The history of the world is more and more a race between education and catastrophe. Okay, so you know, he was saying this, you know, a while back, and we're still in that situation now. Education seems to be more and more the answer to more and more of the problems that we face. But there's also something fundamental about education, which is that you can't buy it, sell it, own it, transfer it, swap it. It's different. It's co-created, it's something that can be shared. You know, there's this quote from B.F. Skinner, is that education is what survives when what has been learned has been forgotten, which is a really profound thought about the nature of knowledge and the way what people are meant to be taking away from educational systems. So we spent about 2 years developing this concept called the Learning Society. We talked to a lot of teachers, a lot of academics, business leaders, around the world, and we wrote this paper called The Learning Society. There's a summary of it on your chairs. And the vision of this is of a world in which everybody is learning, and in which many new partners are involved in many new ways of learning. But what we wanted to check yesterday was, were we making any sense? Had we actually created a vision that people could really latch into? So what we did is we asked that question.
Word association, desk,
chair,
student,
learner,
the learning society,
notebook.
Well, I've heard it before, the learning society.
I'm not sure.
It would be a society of people.
Teacher, student, the learning society.
The learning society is everyone around us.
It's opening up the world of possibilities. Collaboration and communication amongst all adults who work with children.
Being able to collaborate, how we communicate and connect.
It means a group of people who learn together.
It means making and taking the learning opportunities everywhere you go.
Learning society to me means the essence of lifelong learning and connected across the planet.
So, there we go. We were a bit unfair. We really deliberately tried to sort of ambush people. And, you know, as you can see, to some extent we succeeded. But there are some profound thoughts there, particularly at the end. The high-level concept, we thought, okay, phew, we're exactly on. At the beginning, we looked at those clips, and we were thinking, oh dear, it's time to change the presentation. Time to go back to the report itself, actually. But, so we thought, well, okay, we leapt to the end of the story and asked people to give us the answer. That's not really very fair. So we did what we did next. We said, let's go back to the beginning. So we said, you know, why is learning important? Why are people involved in this?
Oh gosh, I love interacting with children and I love sharing knowledge and having them share knowledge with each other.
The aha moment, when that student finally gets a concept, an idea, or something that really sets them on fire.
That's a great question, actually. It should be something that we do from the minute that we're born the other side. And I think it's important that we tool our students and ourselves to continue to be those lifelong learners.
The ability to get a job in the future, I think we have to be able to learn and be able to learn different things in a very rapid rate.
It's what makes the world go round.
Because we're all here together to make a better world. And that's why it's really important.
So there we go. We suddenly were reassured, right? We thought, right, we're on the right track. People are coming up with similar answers to the ones that we used as the basis of the concept of the learning society. So that was reassuring, But we also knew confidence like this wouldn't exist if learning wasn't changing, and in the minds of a lot of people, need to change a whole lot faster. So we said, what's changing? How is learning changing?
Incorporation of technology in classrooms and involving children in that area.
I think the technology is helping a lot. Like being able to use industry standard equipment in the classroom is helping us a lot to make that transition into the real world and much easier.
Students as well as teachers have just they can get their hands on so much more information at a much faster pace.
The student only. I'm no longer the purveyor of knowledge, I'm simply a facilitator. I help students to discover what they need to learn to do whatever it is they're trying to do.
To be collaborative and valuing the work of others.
Empowering kids to be the creators, the producers, and the sharers of knowledge.
In the future, I think we're going to see teachers become more facilitators in the learning process. Kind of not just the sage on the stage kind of thing anymore, but the guy on the side.
Students will take charge of their own learning, and they will be producing their own material.
They'll be more proactive. Learners take charge of their own learning. They're sort of always be designing, creating, experimenting, exploring, to be able to always look at how they can be learning to do things.
So, a lot of ways in which learning is changing, from very specific introduction of certain technologies, the change in the use of technologies, but then through to quite profound changes in the nature of learning. It's more collaborative. People are working together. It needs to be more engaging. Students are going to take charge. It's going to be about creation rather than just sort of receiving knowledge. So if that's where we're trying to get to, how do we get there from here? And crucially, what's in our way? And we did a final set of clips.
We need to shift people's mindsets, to change the way they think about education. It's not just about delivering information from teacher to student, but by learning, by exploring, experimenting, and discovering things.
When we can think about new ways of doing things, I think losing the old paradigm is probably the biggest hindrance to moving forward. I think the major hindrance for most people is a fear, and fear is multifaceted with who the person is that you're dealing with. There could be fear of technology, there could be fear of being outside their comfort zone, there could be fear that the traditional ways are somehow disrespected and put aside.
The challenge of getting to the learning society from where we are, I think, is all about collaboration. No one's going to solve this problem by themselves, and it's going to be money either. It's going to be lots of thoughtful people working together, sharing knowledge. So the key skill is your ability to create content and share and respond. And I'd like to think that Building Learning Communities Conference is an example of exactly that.
So I think we're almost there, and we promised we didn't prompt him for this, but I think Alan sort of summed it up fantastically, not just about where we're going, but why we're here and why we're here today. By the time we got to the end of those videos, we were sort of editing them through sort of late last night, I suddenly thought, well, we're sort of done. I could just sort of stop here. Everyone seems to have got the picture, and we can move on. But I thought, that's not really what today is about. So I've got some additional thoughts. And there's a TV program in the UK, it used to be called Blue Peter. So there was a process whereby what it used to do is sort of teach children how to build things out of trash and cereal boxes, you know, spaghetti out of the Eiffel, into the Eiffel Tower, or, you know, a bridge out of, you know, various tubes and things like that. So, and what they always did is they'd show you part of the building process, and then they'd say, and here's what we made earlier, because of course it would be really boring if you just watched them building it sort of entirely. So what we did is we actually had a short video that we put together that encapsulated why we think we need a learning society. And then what I'm going to do is really unpack how we get there from here.
Thank you.
that's where we ended up. And if you want to use that video, then it is on the Cisco website. It's also on YouTube, and it can be very helpful, I think, for beginning these kind of conversations. So please do feel free to use that. And great credit to Russell Jolly, who's our video guy. I can't take any credit for that, apart from sort of the words, which is, let's be honest, sort of the easiest bit, really, of that thing. The point about that video is it really can be quite disturbing. Okay, we're talking about change, we're talking about doing things differently, using words like radical, disruptive, innovative. These are words that are just thrown around, but they shouldn't be, because if we mean them, if you're making radical change to something, you're doing something quite profound to it. And that means there's going to be real disruptions to people's lives, people's jobs, to teachers, to the way in which schools operate. So how do we do this, going back to the beginning, how do we do this responsibly? How do we ensure that we're innovating responsibly? So we really need this change, and I'm hoping that the next section of my presentation will help explain what it is, why we need it, and how we get there. So what I'm going to do is just explain quickly the concept behind the Learning Society through some numbers. So 60 is the percent of global GDP that's made up by international trade. This is going up and up and up and up. And when the people you're teaching are grown up, this is going to be even higher than it is now. This means two things. First of all, a great need for cultural understanding, working with people across countries, different teams, different skill sets. But it also means, and this is less often thought about, the need for real personal identity and a rooting in what that particular person believes about the world. You think about 21st century skills, and sometimes there are 5, and sometimes there are 7. There's nothing more scary than someone with all of those skills and not a sense of purpose as to why they deploy them. So we have to think about the way in which identity and cultural understanding fit together. 2, 4, 7. For the mathematicians among you, that's half n squared plus half n plus 1 as a sequence. But it is also the number of what are called general purpose technologies in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. These are things like the water wheel or the internet that transcend geographies. They go across industries and they change how we all do everything. So as you can see, it's pretty much doubling every century. We've already had one nanotechnology in the 21st century, so are we going to see a further doubling? The point about this is we're training people for jobs that don't exist yet. So how do we prepare people for that future? 10 is the number of jobs that the average American will have by the age of 42. And none of those jobs will last more than 5 years. This is Department of Labor statistics projecting what's actually going to happen to students who are in school and university now. And the number of those jobs, the duration of those jobs, are just going up and down, respectively. This is a trillion. And according to Google, about a year and a half ago, that was the number of pages on the internet. You know, give or take a few hundred billion here or there. Who's really counting at that stage? The point is, it's an awful lot. You know, knowledge is everywhere. It's not as validated as it used to be. How do you navigate that rather than just know it? For teachers, how do you absorb rather than just create? For students, how do you create rather than just receive? This really changes the nature of knowledge. 10,000. That's the number of hours that Malcolm Gladwell, building on Anders Ericsson's profound work, says that you need to spend on something to become an expert. 10,000 hours. Whether you're a musician or a sports star or some sort of academic, you've got to be spending 10,000 hours. He found it roughly right across a whole range of industries. 1,600 is the number of hours that by the age of 22, most students have spent on any particular subject. There's a gap there. And you can imagine, looking at the numbers we saw before, that we need more and more expertise, not less of it. So the question is, If this is what people are getting inside school, if this is the maximum that they can really get right now with the hours that they spend on subjects in a classroom, where's the rest of it going to come from? Particularly if we need more in the future. 68.8, and I think you're all sensing a quiz is coming later. 68.8 is the percentage of American high school students who graduate after 4 years. Which means that 31.2 don't. This is a high number. And if we're looking at that greater need for expertise, if we're seeing that people need to learn more throughout their lives, need to get more into university, into college, and then move on, this is a problem. And we're not looking at how to increase this by a couple of percent. That's all well and good, that's very interesting. And we absolutely need to do that sort of improvement. But what does it mean to increase that 68.8% figure by a further 50%? How do you get that up to over 90%? You've got to think differently. That isn't about making things go slightly faster or improving efficiency. That's about rethinking what it is that we do. 759 million. That's the number of people, number of adults illiterate in the world. 56 million are the number of students or children of student age who will go without an education by 2015 if we go on at the current rate. 10 million is the number of teachers that we need to teach, to actually populate those education systems if we continue to use current methods. So the lesson here is, this is a global challenge with implications in the US and in developed countries. But it really is a global challenge. And the implication of that final figure, there aren't 10 million teachers. So the point is what do we do instead? How do we get around that problem? How do we meet that challenge? So it's apparent that we need to change, and we really need to change a lot. We're not talking about very small changes here. We're talking about improving, but we're saying that's good, but not good enough. We're saying that we really do need to think about transformational change. Because everything else, frankly, if you look at those numbers, is rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. Because we're really in a lot of trouble. So in this room, right here, right now, for the rest of this conversation, I'm going to talk about the way in which we actually go for the big numbers, the way in which we make the profound changes, the way in which, to Alan's point from before, we think about systems, we think about long-term change, but how we begin it today, and how we begin it when you go back to your schools and you continue the work that you've been doing. But before we get to that, let's have a quiz. So, Debbie and Jean, two questions, and this really is just answer quickly. So, do you need to be in position? Do you need to be watching? All right, okay, so, question one. What's the 10,000 figure refer to? Sorry, go on, Gene, choose somebody.
Hours needed to be an expert.
That's right, excellent, okay, great. Good. Jeannie, you reset, are you ready? Yeah.
Sorry, no. Oh, she's got her hand up already. She doesn't know.
The second question is, you can't have your hand up already. I mean, you know, so, is 56 million, which was that refer to?
It's the number of children who are illiterate by 2015.
That's right, that's right. Okay, great, great. Thank you. So, this is a slide you might not be expecting to see. That when we're talking about innovation, schools are a great place to start. Now, there are different points of view on this. On one point of view, you will hear that schools are inherently innovative and creative. Every day, students are creating work. Teachers are adapting to student needs. That you see the development of new pedagogy, the spreading of it across classrooms. You see that schools are creative and innovative. But on the other hand, you hear a story which is, and it goes something like this. If you fell asleep 100 years ago and you woke up today, everything would be different, apart from school, which would pretty much look exactly the same. The point is, both of those stories are true. Schools are both innovative and look kind of similar than they did before. And here's my response to that question, particularly when people go for the 100 years question. I say this question. I say, where's my jetpack? Okay, let me explain what this means. So, the first point is, the world hasn't changed as much as we think it has. So if you look back 100 years, cars still have 4 wheels, bicycles have 2 wheels. We still eat food, we're not on tablets yet, I don't know if anyone else is. I don't have a jetpack. I don't think you know anyone who does either. There are some people, but you wouldn't want them anywhere near the children that you teach. I'm telling you that. So, point one, the world hasn't changed as profoundly as people think it has, from a sort of basic point of view. Point two, there's a reason that schools haven't changed really quickly with every passing fad. Schools do something that's very complex. Schools do something that's very, very important, as we talked about before. And crucially, schools do something that's very long-term. If you make a change now, just because you think it's a good idea, the impact on some student's life doesn't appear for probably around 20 years, the latest research shows. Yes, you'll see the test scores and things like that, but you won't see whether they're doing well in life, or happily married, or got a good family, or in prison. You won't see those fundamental life characteristics until much later. So we need to think very carefully before we change education. So the question, therefore, is what is change that's important? And the example I give here is the Walkman and the iPod. They're basically the same. So we think that the iPod changed the world, but of course it didn't. If you were a Martian landing from outer space, you would say, yeah, it's kind of the same thing. You wouldn't say it in English, obviously. But you'd say, it's kind of the same thing. It's a box. It plays this music stuff, and you listen to it through protuberances on the human head. Okay? Nothing's really changed in that. So the Walkman and the iPod fulfill the same role. So we're looking at the way in which things are done, what they mean. And then when you look at it, you say, well, what is important about the iPod? Well, it's unfortunately not the design. Sorry, Jonathan Ive, it is pretty. The compactness is nice. But it is iTunes. iTunes is profound. So the big breakthrough with the iPod was the poor lawyers who behind the scenes were wrestling with the music companies, organizing the contracts to allow you to download music rather than to have it just, you know, on a CD. And the same thing happened with the iPhone. What's the big breakthrough? Well, the big breakthrough with the iPhone is unlimited data from AT&T. That's the big breakthrough, right? I mean, yes, it's a nice phone and everything, but it's just a phone. We've had email before, we've had photos, we've had better cameras for a long time. And now, and we even had antennas that worked. And now, we have an iPhone. So, the final point is, therefore, if we think about changing that way, and I think of that as a script, right? You change the way in which people do things. Okay, that's the important change. Schools have changed. And Clayton Christensen has a great account of this, which I won't go into, in Disrupting Class, where he says schools have fulfilled 4 different, really different purposes, even over the last 100 years. First of all, providing and extending democracy. Secondly, meeting the needs of everybody and keeping them in school. Thirdly, keeping America competitive. Now there's a big one. And number 4, eliminating poverty. Now that's a big one. Okay, so given that we're dealing with the same buildings, similar workforce, you know, the same kind of concepts, he says schools have done remarkably well compared to almost all private sector companies that you look at. It's a great account, you should read it. Mainly it's an account of private sector failure rather than public sector success, but it gives us respect when we look at innovation. So the crucial point is we're not in a black hole. How do you spot real change? Here's a graph. I'm a research guy. I promise it'll be very brief. This is a graph that compares, along here, the amount of money that's spent on education, and up here, the test scores. Most importantly, it doesn't matter where people are in particular, that there's no relationship between the two. If money could solve the problems of education, we wouldn't be here today. Because we would get it. You would get the money. If it was clear what it could be done, but here, it's absolutely not true. The point is, there's bad news here, in the sense that this isn't easy, you can't just throw money at this problem, but there's great news as well, because it is empowering. This means that you can do great work in your school with whatever resources you have to hand. And I want to explain how. So, how do you determine which changes are important? And this is the way that I think you can think about this. And you might wonder, who's this guy to say this? Well, in Cisco, we've been involved in an awful lot of innovations along the way, some in education, a lot elsewhere. And the point about it is we say you can achieve single-digit improvements by deploying technology and implementing it well. But you only get double-digit improvement, transformation, the kind of change that we all saw was essential, not optional, if what you do is you re-engineer what it is that you do. And the way in which you should look at innovations, whether they're technological innovations or organizational innovations, is whether they change what I call the script. Now, this concept was pioneered by a guy called Bart Lutherboom at the University of Tilburg, but we won't go into that. The point is how do you tell which ones are important here? So here's an example. Think of the difference between a restaurant and a fast food chain. You do the same thing. You go in, you pay money, you get food, you leave. What's the difference? Why has this transformed the economic and social landscape of America first and then the rest of the world? Well, it's because the script has changed. So whereas the script in a restaurant used to be choose, be served, eat, and pay, the script in a fast food restaurant is choose, pay, carry your food yourself, eat it, clean up, leave. So you're not only doing similar things in different order, but you're actually doing completely new steps. And this has built an entire industry. And you can see this around the place. Again, think about the way in which industries have changed. Think about low-cost airlines. You still get to where you're going. How have they actually completely re-engineered what they do? The way they do it is by changing the script. They move activities. You have to do a lot more as the passenger, right? And therefore, that lowers their costs and they can offer things more cheaply. So we see the same in schools. Here's a sort of pretty non-traditional classroom, really, a kind of almost Dickensian kind of classroom we're dealing with here. And the point is that students sort of turn up, teacher says things, students repeat, students maybe some enforced brutality for discipline purposes, and then students go home and get tested later on. In a modern classroom, what we're really dealing with is people arrive, they engage, probably with the teacher to understand the problem. We're looking at the conducting of independent research, probably collaboration, like Alan Forst right at the beginning. Some formative assessment, some review, strengths and weaknesses. Do some more exercises, work together. Finally, some summative assessment, end. It's a completely different script. And it's enabled by changes in pedagogy and, if used correctly, changes in technology. And that is the way in which we think about profound change, real innovation in Cisco. It's not about replacing a textbook with a Kindle or replacing a pad and paper with an iPad. If all you've done is swap those things, you might as well have just used swapped a blue pen with a red pen. You're not really doing anything with that. What you've got to do is say, well, how does this help me re-engineer the learning process? So the big question is, does it change the script? What is the current script? How do you currently organize the learning process? The role of students, the role of the teacher, how does that then change through the change that you're making? Classic example, of course, is knowledge. So in universities, way back in the Middle Ages, knowledge was scarce. You had to be a university fellow, essentially, to deliver knowledge. But then we had the printing press, and suddenly books were everywhere. Didn't actually make that much of a change to begin with, but by the 20th century, knowledge could be distributed in textbooks. And at that point,
Teachers did less and less of just passing on knowledge, and more of what only they could do, which was teaching. And then finally, of course, we're seeing the logical extension of this, and we're seeing free knowledge, we're seeing the rise of the internet, we're seeing the fact that knowledge can be anywhere and it can be there very quickly. So how do we do this? How do we think about whether it changes the script? And again, as I was reflecting back to the challenge we had before, if it doesn't change the script, we're not interested. If we get 2% more, if we save 10 minutes a week, if we improve very incrementally, those are significant changes, but not for us, not today. We're looking at how do you do transformational change? How do you reshuffle, remix learning, and allow it to happen in new places, in new ways, to engage and re-engage students? So at this point, where do we look? Where do we find the examples that we need to follow? This is one of my favorite quotes. It's a William Gibson quote. A lot of you will be familiar with it. The future is here, it's just not widely distributed. Now this is true, right? I mean, there are people who knew about Google 5 years before the rest of us, and you can just think about this with every single technology. It's around somewhere. We should not be scared. We can go and find this. There are lessons we can learn. There are reasons why conferences like this are absolutely crucial. And we went, and we looked at some of the world's most extreme environments. And we published a report called Learning from the Extremes, and I think you've got a summary of that as well. And we worked with Charlie Leadbeater and Annika Wong, and they traveled to slums in Africa, to the favelas in South America, and they came across forms of learning that you really would not imagine could exist. And we were thinking of subtitling this report when we came back to the US and came back to the UK and we had all of these challenges of technology and money. And we said, we're thinking of subtitling, you know, you think you've got problems, okay? We're dealing with people here who've got no teachers, no schools, certainly no technology, and yet they're working it through. Now, look for the process changes because, of course, you do have schools. You do have technology. You do have access to budgets. So there's no point learning the extreme lessons, but they rethought learning, which was what I thought was most profound. So the first example I want to draw on is from that report, Learning from the Extremes. It's called Bugado EduTrade, and it's in South Africa. It's run out of the slums of Cape Province by a woman called Flip Asphalt. And what she did is she realized there weren't enough trained teachers, and those who were available often weren't organized well enough in order to deliver the learning that's needed in South Africa. So she developed a peer learning method and a cascade method. So working with tertiary graduates and unemployed teachers, she actually developed a small group of people who would become mentors to a further group of people, who would teach students around anything that they found interesting. So whatever their expertise was, whether it was dance or mathematics or soccer, they would relate it to a profound truth in education. And then this would cascade. They've reached 6,000 different students. And Flick Asphalt changed the script, not just by changing the roles around that we've seen, because she had no other choice, but because she actually turned students into teachers and made collaboration at the very core of what she did, because she had no other alternative. The second example that we see is we see the sharing of scarce resources. And this is different because this is just creating a script where there wasn't one before. We see the, we're working with our colleagues in Tanberg. Cisco and Tanberg have just started working together. They work very closely with the Arkansas School of Math, Arts and Sciences, and through the Office of Distance Education, delivering that kind of education now to 3,700 students in 100 different locations around the state. We see a similar example in Ernestwood Grange in the UK, in Coventry, where they have live Spanish tuition from teachers who are elsewhere, because this previously wasn't possible. They didn't have access to native Spanish speakers to extend that knowledge. I was in China earlier this year, and I traveled to Chengdu, which is one of the biggest cities you may have never heard of. It's absolutely enormous. It has the panda breeding sanctuary. So if you ever get a chance to go, do that. You can see it's sort of 20 pandas, which is great. And there, what they're doing is they are doing remote video education for huge conferences in China. We're dealing with hundreds of thousands of different students, week in, week out, on an almost industrial scale. It's not an ideal solution. They know it's not an ideal solution, but it is a way of giving people a script who didn't have one before. And we're working in India on a program we call the Remote Education Center out of our Bangalore headquarters, which is doing a very similar thing. And then there are school systems that are thinking completely differently about the way in which we think about learning, particularly project-based learning, working in teams, authentic projects, student voice in the design of those. And we're working with New York City, particularly with the iSchool and what will now be the iZone, in terms of rethinking the way in which education is delivered. We've got a short video.
We launched the Innovation Zone in order to highlight three main kinds of innovations in schools around how instruction is delivered, around how we use time, and around how we use teachers in school.
For the iSchool, innovation means rethinking how we teach kids, what we teach kids, when we teach kids, and what we teach kids. So what we know is that using online coursework that are individualized and self-paced, students can get a huge breadth of knowledge in a relatively short period of time, which frees us up to do another level of knowledge. Explore smaller pieces of the curriculum, but go very deeply. And we do that for our modules, which are challenge-based, interdisciplinary, problem-based learning.
A very practical application of innovation for us is in scheduling. If you looked at a student's schedule, you would see that it changes every 9 weeks. Every student has a completely different schedule because it's about what courses they need to take, what their interests are, and what time looks like for each student.
The fact that we have this very much at your own pace, very much personalized test prep material, is what gives us the room to do these really in-depth real-world problems.
It makes me feel confident that I, you know, working on my patient, I'm more confident that I actually know what I'm doing.
So the crucial point there again is, yes, it was great to see it on video. Yes, it was well articulated. But the point is not the technology that lies behind it, but again, the way in which the script has been changed. Different uses of time, that's a very interesting way of thinking about this, about concentrating, sort of almost rote learning into certain amounts of time and then going very, very deep on particular subjects. We see something similar at the Lumiar Institute in Brazil, where students actually at the beginning of the year determine themes and questions, and teachers receive an awful lot of specialist support from non-teaching staff to do things like develop video and help with multimedia. And what they've done is they've managed to actually develop this sort of comprehensive 21st century learning experience in the middle of nowhere in Brazil. So the final example that we've thought of is this question of co-creation. And this really is a changing script because it's saying, you know, the content used to come from over here, it now comes from over here. Content is now part of the learning process. The actual process of developing it is important. We worked in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina with Jefferson Parish in Louisiana. And the following year, there was another hurricane evacuation. And we were working there, and they were really sort of started working on blogs and equivalent technologies very, very quickly. And what happened was, is whilst the hurricane evacuation was going on, AP English continued using blogs, using email, and in fact, a lot of the students said it was always better because they were able to review the content much more thoroughly and then actually sort of post back, and it became more collaborative. But we also see this again in Jefferson Parish. This is an example here. The Ogden Museum developed a junior creators project where students had, you know, flip cams and videos and did podcasts, or actually record their own sort of e-portfolio approaches to the field trip that they developed. And, you know, we're at the core of this, and hence we've been giving out the flip videos. And we're going to just sort of demonstrate that quickly today, I think. Should we do that? Is that good? And actually sort of see how this works. And the crucial reason that we like Flip, and frankly the reason my sister bought the company, is it's just very straightforward, and it's safe, and you can manage it very quickly. Gene's better.
So in the spirit of time, I'll accelerate this just a little bit. How many of you use a flip camera or some type of digital camera in your class? Just about everyone. One of the things as I work with schools I always hear is how challenging it is to manage your videos and to search for them, to find them. So we're not actually going to create one right now. You all know how to do that. But I'm going to show you a new tool that we've developed called Show and Share, which allows you to really kind of manage and edit and archive and search for your videos. So if I were to go to a video that we've preloaded on here, and this is on Dissolved Oxygen, I'm just going to select the button that says Manage Your Video. And as you can see, once I save my video, all I have to do is plug it into my laptop, upload the video, I can title it, I can write a description. But what I think is really interesting is then I have the option of tagging my video. Now the great thing about this is it's all behind, it's safe and secure, it's all behind your school's firewalls. So it's not out in the public domain, it's something that you manage in your school or your district, wherever you decide to provide access. So I can tag it. That way, if I want to go back and search for videos, it comes up with those keywords. If other teachers or students want to search, you can do that as well. You can see how easy it is to just manage that video. Now, by going back to the video, if I were to click on it and actually play it, you'll see that a screen will come up with the video. It'll also come up with some options for me on managing that video. So let's play the video first.
So dissolved oxygen is a measure of how much oxygen is in the water. It's as simple as that. And we measure it because fish and crabs and oysters, all the big critters that we care about, need to breathe air in order to survive, just like we.
So you can see that's a video clip, and then it matches to some of the tags that I put in here. One of the really cool features is I can also have a transcript of that video. So as I upload my videos, then I can have it transcribed. I can also share this with other teachers or students, and they can log into the website. They can add their comments to this video, how they might use it in a lesson, what they thought was useful, how they might edit it, and so on. And you can kind of manage through all that. So it really becomes a great tool as you're trying to manage the videos that you're creating and your students are creating. Great.
Thank you, Gene. That's great. So, I suppose the main lesson of this is when you're actually looking at all of the innovations you've heard about over the past couple of days, and you will hear about again tomorrow, is that there's three different categories. The first one is those that won't help at all, so you should obviously just ignore those. We've all got limited amounts of time. The second ones are ones that will help improve something you're currently doing, and those you should absolutely adopt. You should see how they fit into your current teaching practice and how they can actually improve it, get your time back, improve student performance. But the final one, and the most important one, are which ones will help you reinvent, which ones will help you change what you do. You need to take longer to integrate those, to absorb those, but those will lead to the most profound changes. So what we're hoping is that the crucial point is asking the question, and what can you do? So we came up with five different options. One is think about team-based, authentic learning, getting the students involved in assessing each other, establishing a global partnership, building interdisciplinary links between subjects to help that crossover and prepare students for a future in which problems don't break down easily by discipline or by subject. And finally, developing digital learning projects, not just because of the skills they teach themselves, but because of the way they inherently do all of these different things. Students do need to drive them, students do need to learn from each other, and they will inherently be interdisciplinary. So please, spread the word, take this action. And when you're thinking about real change as opposed to superficial change, again, the point about the way in which a technology transforms what you do rather than just looks attractive, the question is does it change the script? Thank you very much.
couldn't understand what I just saw, I had to ask Debbie, who was sitting next to me. I didn't get that the software translated the video into text. Did you get that?
No.
I didn't get that, so I had to ask that question. And then Debbie told me the next iteration is it's going to do it in multiple languages. So that if you produce a video, you'll be able to get the script of that video automatically generated in multiple languages. So the globalization of sharing content around the world, the boundary of language, at least in terms of the translation of the text of any video project your students produce, will be taking care of you almost second by second of video into text. Do any of you have this now? Nobody in the room has that. Well, just the implications of, you have that? You, yeah, of course, Celine has that. All right, and well, Jen, you have some, I just want to prepare, hang on for just a second. Richard, I just want to share the emergency of Katrina, and in Hong Kong, slang the flu. I think it's a really interesting exercise, because we heard this earlier today as well from Michael Wesch, that extreme conditions actually have a lesson for those of us who are not experiencing a hurricane. But I think a realistic point of view is that imagine you have to deliver instruction to your school because the local health commissioner of your state tells you that bird flu is coming and you must shut down your schools. This is not unrealistic, given the development of flu. And so take an extreme situation in your schools, you have to shut down for 2 weeks, and you still have to deliver instruction. Plan for that now. And I think by taking an extreme situation, it will force some conversations that we wouldn't have in the day-to-day operation without a crisis. Don't ever waste a good crisis.
Is that the lesson?
That's good. Don't waste a good crisis. Thank you so much. All right, and with that, thank you, Richard. No more prizes, right? That's prizes? Okay.